I'm Carlos Virgen, digital news director at The Day and producer and host of Case Unsolved. I recently sat down with reporters Karen Florin, Erica Moser, and Lindsay Boyle, and producers Tim Cotter and Peter Wappi to discuss the first season of Case Unsolved, including a couple of updates we recently learned from law enforcement. We also talked about our preliminary plans for season two.
I thought we'd start off by talking about kind of the process, what we learned during the reporting and production of the podcast, and how maybe, especially for the reporters, how you think or what your experience was as far as the difference in reporting for audio versus when you're writing a story. You know, any insights that you guys learned, any kind of or frustrations that you guys experience? If you guys want to go around, and it doesn't have to be in order, so anybody can jump in at any point.
I would say, for one thing, this was the longest that I had spent working on one project, and one thing I think I learned from doing this was, and this is very different doing audio compared to writing for a bunch of different reasons, but one thing is, you know, a lot of people aren't just going to take a while to just showing up and having a camera in their face and having really no idea kind of why you're there, what you're doing, what you want, and that sometimes you need to just take time to explain to people, this is what we're doing, this is our goal, gain their trust, because that's a hard thing with people, whether you're just out in the community or if you want people to talk to you.
That's interesting, because we showed up as The Day, a newspaper, and a couple of times we would show up with an audio recorder and a microphone, which was all, you know, already kind of a little unsettling for some people. And then we had to explain to them what we were doing. We weren't just writing a story. We were producing a podcast, which then led to the question from some people, what's a podcast, right? Anybody else experience that?
Yeah, 100%. But, I mean, I would just say that everything about this is different than the average print article that you're going to be working on, with the exception of one thing, but which we were just talking beforehand, jog my memory. I got lucky because my case is much newer than the cases that Erica and Karen covered. So I was still able to use the handy-dandy Facebook creeping to find some people that were familiar with Erica, and I was able to track them down on Facebook Messenger, which is definitely something that I do day-to-day. But aside from that, I think, you know, I wanted to write my whole episode, all three of them, and I've never written for audio at all. I've never written a podcast. So the idea of a narrative arc is different, right? Like, you, when you're writing a newspaper article, you're going to want to pretty much throw everything out there in a first sentence or two, and you can't do that if you're writing for a podcast. And I would say another thing, my master file probably was, I want to say, 15,000 to 20,000 words of partially transcribed audio. Mm-hmm. So there's just the sheer amount of material to work with. I actually would go on bike rides and just run through in my head, how do I even organize this?
Yeah, that definitely, the workload. I mean, I kind of suspected that it was going to be a really intensive process and a lot of work. And Peter obviously has experience producing video, so he obviously had that kind of foresight about how long it was going to take, but it, you know, the amount of audio that we were able to get, that we were lucky enough to get, was kind of almost a little overwhelming, having to listen through it all. So that was, for me, one of the things that shocked me. Karen, any thoughts?
Well, so to some extent, I just did what I usually do. You know, I looked, when we decided which case I was going to cover, I looked into the archive, and then we went and we did knock on some doors. Carlos, you came with me with the microphone.
Right.
It wasn't that far out of the realm of my experience, because I've certainly had photographers and videographers with me before. And then, you know, conducted the interviews. They were recorded too. People were surprisingly comfortable, I thought, with the recordings.
Yeah.
And then put together the story. So there were two things different about the way that we did the Desiree Michaud case. I did not write a script for this, and we kind of just conducted interviews ad-libbing, and I thought that worked really well for me. We all have different reporting styles, so you folks interviewed me, and then we did recorded, so that worked really well for me. But the extraordinary thing was that I didn't just write the story and have it published, right? So we would go over what the material that we had, and, you know, Tim Cotter listened to it, and we'd discuss it. And then one day you said, hey, let's get somebody to, let's bring in some actors to read some of these parts, right? Let's have actors do the hypnotism of the witness to Desiree's right. murder. And that really just did kick it up a notch, you know, all the team input on it. Right. It was like not really one reporter, but a handful of reporters working on a story over a longer period of time. And I think the product showed that.
Yeah, getting those different perspectives, you know, listening to early cuts and then meeting together and write, taking notes and kind of giving feedback. Tim, managing the project, what anything that stands out to you?
Well, Erica mentioned how long it took, and I'm thinking now how labor-intensive it really was. I mean, every time a reporter went out, generally you went with them. So you're sending two people, not just one, and then there's all that transcribing, you know, that Lindsay talked about. So it took us a real long time. It was just, you know, a lot of work, a lot of extra hours for everybody. If these were print stories, they would have been in the paper so much quicker. Mm-hmm. But we thought it was worth it in the end, and I think people who listened did too. And the other point about the podcast, I remember going back when we first started video, and Peter can probably remember this too, but people would be like, yeah, you can interview me and you can take my picture, but I do not want to be on video. And we've kind of broken down that barrier where you don't hear that as often. And now it was, you know, we're recording them, and this word podcast, I think, scared a lot of people. Yeah. And so we had to break down that barrier. And I think Lindsay had one person who wouldn't go on, you know, who would have an interview via email but wouldn't be recorded. So there was a little bit of that, but it's just extra work for everybody to, like Erica said, get their trust that, yeah, we're doing this story, but we're doing it as an audio story. And, you know, people kind of, that makes people nervous, but you have to kind of talk them off the ledge and get them to do it.
Yeah. Peter, do you have any thoughts about that? What you kind of learned? I mean, you obviously had the most experience as far as producing a multimedia project.
Yeah. So I think that the process was pretty similar for me compared to the types of stories that I've done in the past. I'm used to working, like I think a lot of us are, on my own, or maybe collaborating with one other person. And this was a real team effort. And so figuring out that team workflow is part of what made things take longer. I think in the end, the product was better because we had a lot of different ideas and different input into it, and I think it'll help us going forward. And I agree with Tim's observation that people are some people are wary subjects of stories being on video or being recorded. And I mean, we've on the one hand broken down some of that discomfort or unfamiliarity with the format, but I also think we live in a time now where people are so much more sensitive and aware of what it means to have their image or their voice go out over the internet to everybody. And that's almost a bigger barrier, where in the past, I come from a photography background, so there was a time where you said, hey, I want to take your picture and put it in the paper, and everybody was super excited about that. And now people are wary about, like, I think where their image or their voice or their video or their name is going to end up.
All right. And some of us have kind of alluded to that collaborative nature of the project, and you kind of alluded to it a little bit, Peter, about like how we kind of figured out the roles on the fly. Really, we didn't really discuss, like, you know, Peter's going to do X and Y, and I'm going to do this and that. So it was really kind of organic the way that it developed, and I enjoyed that part especially. And then the other part that I was really struck by and was I really liked was the trust that we had to have, especially, you know, not having done this together, and not the reporters especially giving up a lot of control over the kind of final product was good was an interesting experience. Anything you guys would do differently next time? And there, for all intents and purposes, there will be a second season, so we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little while. But anything we'd do different next time?
I would say technically I should start earlier. I had a lot of the materials well before I actually went through and sat down and wrote the scripts. A lot of the script writing happened at the very last minute. So the ideal would be to start earlier, but I'm a journalist. I work on deadline. I can't make any promises.
Yeah, deadline. Yeah, I think that idea of deadlines and having mile markers or a timeline where we check off things as we go, I think that would be helpful for sure.
I think with Desiree, we kind of whiteboarded the narrative arc that Lindsay was talking about. And then we kind of dropped that, and maybe that would be good for all of them, because I think on some of them,
we were still
especially trying. Spicer. I think we ended up on the fly moving stuff. Like maybe that's better in the second part. Maybe that's where if we had maybe, but it was also organic because the reporting was happening.
Spicer's
else.
Spicer's a good example because we discovered new details about the case while we were reporting, while we were editing and recording. So, yeah.
But from the Spicer case we went to, we almost didn't do it because we didn't have enough to, we had a lot, So it was really, there wasn't much we could do about that.
Yeah, but on the other hand, having that baseline of a outline to really kind of sketch the arc, I think, is helpful.
And I think that's something I've thought more about as I've listened to other podcasts that, again, with the medium, unlike with a relatively short news article, you want to just start with, here's the summary, here's what happened, and get the most important stuff at the top. Here it's to keep people listening, to draw people in. Right. Obviously, everyone, the basic premise is this person was murdered. We don't know who did it. So you have that, but also to kind of step back for a bit and build up back to that. And it's made me think a lot more about narrative arcs. And when I listen to other podcasts, you can hear sometimes how great it is that they start with a premise and then say, wait, let's go way back and build up to how we got to this point.
Anybody else?
One of the things that I kept saying to all of us, I think, while we were doing it is that people are going to be more willing to talk to us once they see how respectfully we're treating the subject matter. And that's a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from people is that you were so very respectful. So I just would try to remember to keep our principles, our reporting principles, as we do this, as eager as we are,
Which is interesting because many of us are podcast fans, and some of the podcasts that delve in this kind of this subject matter aren't necessarily journalistic. They don't come from a journalism background, so they take different angles, approaches, which we kind of had discussions throughout the process to make sure that, yes, we're producing a podcast, but we're also the Day newspaper.
Well, that whole idea of bringing in actors to reenact something, obviously that's not something we would do in a it wouldn't happen in a print setting, but in terms of our journalistic standards, we talked about that and wanted to be very transparent about it, because it would be very easy to not be transparent about that and then have someone listen and maybe misunderstand and think they were hearing the actual recording and not a reenactment.
Erica, going back to what you were talking about, listening to a new podcast, has the experience changed the way that you listen to podcasts? Are you listening to specific? For me, it's like the editing and the pacing and the music and the layering of audio, which, in the past, what didn't stand out to me as much. But now I think I find myself picking out some of those details more than before.
I think I'm listening more into all of the different avenues that people will go down, especially, I know, just in our discussions amongst ourselves, I talk all the time about In the Dark with season 2. It is such an exhaustive podcast in terms of getting into everything. And sometimes, with podcasts, we're obviously thinking first and foremost about the interviews, and having those, you know, one-on-one conversations with people. But even beyond that, with our own reporting, what can we find through, you know, judicial records and probate records and land records? And there's just, depending on the person, so much out there that you can look into, and you can end up down some rabbit holes, which sometimes might be nothing and sometimes could be really interesting.
And we spent time in some looking at some records that we eventually didn't really use for various reasons, but
Well, for me, you know, like a lot of people, Serial was my first podcast, and I we listen or read everything as journalists, but it was so good, you just get caught up in it, and you kind of listen to it just, you know, as a normal person or whatever, average person. But now I tend to listen to them as a journalist and editor, thinking, you know, how did they find that person? Mm-hmm. How did they get that interview? How did they get that ambient sound? So that would be the change for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's 100% different for me now, honestly. I love, these guys will be sick of hearing it, but I love Ear Hustle. That's a podcast I listen to frequently. And, you know, it's, for me, one of the things that was hard when I was writing my script was figuring out how to introduce new people or reintroduce people without just saying their name over and over again. And so I'm listening about, like, you know, a lot into the different ways that the podcast transitioned from person to person, that they introduce new material, new ideas, new people. So that's one thing that I definitely find myself noticing more. And also the ambient noise, for sure. That there was a jail cell door closed in an episode I listened to this morning, and I noticed that. Maybe I wouldn't have before.
That's probably another thing that Peter and I have discussed since we finished this series, is how to better plan on collecting some of that ambient noise, going to the street where the person lived, you know, going to a park, that kind of stuff, which we did a little bit of, but I think moving forward, we're definitely gonna, that'll be part of that sketch, where here's the characters, here's the available material, and here's the possible audio. Peter, any feedback on listening to podcasts differently? You're obviously a big podcast person.
So I listen a lot differently now to the way they write. So that was my area of least expertise. Right. I come from a photography and video background and then editing. So the recording and the editing and the natural sound is all in my wheelhouse, but the writing portion of it isn't. So I have a much greater appreciation for the podcasts that do it really well. And so I'm always listening, like, okay, did they script this? Was this, was this just off the cuff? Mm-hmm. Like, is this conversation between the two hosts or reporters, is that something that they planned out beat for beat or word for word? Or are they just that good that they can just sit down and do it? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know the answer to that a lot of the time.
Let's go back to, so season one, we covered the three cases, the Michaud case, the Sirioni, the Spicer case. And since we finished the series, we published a couple of updated episodes answering some questions from listeners. Any updates that we can talk about? We recently went out to talk to Detective Sergeant Heather Beauchamp at the Groton Town Police. Do you guys want to share, Erica? And
yeah, so Detective Sergeant Beauchamp, she had just been promoted the day before, so it was an interesting time to be sitting down with her. She said they did actually receive a tip which came in through the Eastern District Major
for the Spicer case.
For the Spicer case, yes.
So we did receive a tip, I guess we would call it, on Spicer, which came in through Eastern District Major Crime. So we are currently following up on that. Besides just telling you that we have received a tip, right now we have not investigated enough to tell you what the tip involves. But hopefully, you know, as we progress with this, we'll have more information. So we're basically in the early stages of this current tip on the Spicer case.
Has that tip taken you outside of Groton or outside of Connecticut?
No. And it does involve a name that has been brought up in the case before. So elaborating on whether that person was a potential suspect or not, he was never a strong enough suspect clearly for any type of arrest, but the name is familiar with us, with the investigation.
And so she said that tip didn't take them outside of Groton or Connecticut. They're still in the early stages of investigating that tip, so there was nothing else she could really say in terms of what the tip involved. Right. But she did say that it does involve a name that has been brought up in the case before, but that he was never a strong enough suspect for any type of arrest, but that the name is familiar with them. And another interesting thing was that they were doing some kind of reorganization within the department. So they've merged the detective division with the investigative division. And investigator Lauren Fippinger has been kind of diving deep into the
files.
The Spicer homicide. And so this is all kind of part of, and this is something that Detective Sergeant Beauchamp has talked to us a lot about before, in terms of over the past 23 years, people coming in, getting fresh eyes on the case. So Investigator Fippinger was a patrol officer, then a youth officer, mostly is focused on juvenile crimes, but also human trafficking, internet crimes, and now she's looking into the Spicer files as well. And then another thing that Detective Sergeant Beauchamp told us was that the lab said they could do further testing with smaller amounts of DNA. And that is a struggle a lot of times with cold cases. The samples have degraded, but now they can use less of a sample to get a profile.
So the technology, the science has improved, right? Because she did, in reporting the Spicer case and a couple of the cases that she was interviewed for, they talked about how, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever, they kept the evidence in a different way than they would now. They've learned, so that's a good update, a good thing. So maybe updates, hopefully, in the coming months.
So unfortunately, Detective Sergeant Beauchamp did not receive any new tips on the Desiree Michaud case. She did clear up something with us that came up quite a bit, regarding Desiree's property and her paintings. She said that she had been through a disc, that they made when they reinvestigated the case. They digitized everything, put it on disc, and there really were none of Desiree's paintings or none of her art on there. She said there still is some of her property, which Desiree's family, I think, is under the impression that it's a large amount of paintings and property, but Detective Sergeant Beauchamp said it would all fit into a duffel bag. Mm-hmm. So I still have continued to sort of ask her, like, what's in that duffel bag, but she hasn't actually gone and physically looked at it yet, but doesn't seem to think it's anything of significance that that we'd even really be interested in.
Any feedback that we've heard from family members or friends or any kind of encounters you've had with people that have said, hey, the podcast, anybody?
I'll take a pass at both of those. Just for the record, so my case obviously was out of Norwich, so I was not dealing with the same detective sergeant that these two were. I did reach out to Lieutenant Christopher Conley last week. Unfortunately, same thing, no new tips in the case, but from what we understand, there are very few people who would have this information. So it really just depends on someone having a change of heart, I think. As far as feedback, I got all kinds of feedback. I think probably my favorite feedback came from an immigration lawyer who's also a friend of mine. And he listened to the first episode and he was like, you don't sound like you sound... when I hear you talking in a coffee shop or in a bar, right, you sound a little different, and maybe you would do better to sound more like yourself. So I tried to take that feedback and turn it around in episodes 2 and 3, and I think he was right. I think it did sound better. So that was kind of cool. Honestly, I was visiting Seattle and Oregon over the summer, and some people in Oregon had listened to my podcast, obviously friends of my partner, but still, I was at my gym in Hamden the other day and people came up and they were like, hey, you guys did such a good job. Like, it's so much more professional than we thought it would be. And I'm like, you know my name? How did you even know to listen to this? So it's been a really interesting experience in the family, too. I worked really closely with the nephew, Jay, the whole time. And when he did give me feedback, he said it was so hard for him to listen, but he thinks I did a fair portrayal. And that's what we were striving for, so...
We've been asked for advice.
Other newspapers in New England, I think we're a little bit ahead of the curve, and Peter's going to sit on an upcoming panel on podcasting, so people are aware in the industry of what we did and are interested in it, and I think. Again, that labor intensity is what holds people back, because it takes people and time and equipment. I mean, we've invested in equipment. When I think of the three cases, I'm kind of not surprised that there hasn't been tips on Desiree, because that was just one of those cases. It's old, and, you know, when you talk about DNA, because she was a prostitute. The other two, though, you know, seem kind of solvable when you think about it. And you know, on Spicer, as we reported, and we hadn't reported previously, so this was new information, you know, the scene was not secured right away. They had to exhume the body, you know, a few weeks later or whatever. So you don't know, but you wonder if things were done differently. I think the expert that you talked to, on unsolved cases, talked about the first 48 hours and how important that is. And in that case, I think some of those 48 hours were probably wasted. And then in the Sirioni one...
there was no murder scene, so...
Right, and also, I think Lindsay even covered 10 years later, they went to an apartment in Norwich. Right. Now, if somebody had given them that address right away... You know, what would have happened, but instead it was 10 years later, and you know, what are you going to find? You know, so on those two, you just think, God, if things broke a little differently, maybe they solved those cases.
And it seems like definitely it's going to rely on somebody coming forward and saying,
right,
this and that. Next season, we've kind of started conversations about doing a second season in our Facebook group. If you're not aware, we started a Facebook group, and you're more than welcome to join at facebook.com/groups/caseunsolved. We asked people, we kind of threw out the fact that we were thinking of doing a second season, and even while we were producing the series, people were throwing out names of cases that they thought we should look into. And some of those would take us outside of our immediate region. Anything that we could share, Tim? Anybody?
I'm going to pass it over to Karen.
So there's a case out of Madison of a woman named Barbara Hamburg, who died, I think it was 8 years ago. And I think there might be a lot of interesting aspects to that case. She was involved in this, I don't want to call it a scheme, but it was a program called Gifting Tables, with other women, where it was almost like a pyramid where they were trying to make money. And so there was a prosecution of a lot of people in that case, which we might be able to look into. But also, on the day that she was killed, she was due in court for a divorce. So there's some interesting aspects of that. I have another case that I've followed for a long time. It's the disappearance of April Dawn Pennington out of Montville. George Leniart has been convicted of killing her, but her body has never been found. Mm. So I wonder if there's some interest in that.
Right.
Leniart is serving life without parole, but his case is before the Supreme Court right now and might have some traction. Case is interesting to me as well. I'd love to hear what our listeners think of either one of those ideas or any other ideas.
Right.
One thing I'd also be interested in hearing from listeners is kind of what they thought about the format of the, you know, the three cases over the one season that we all kind of, while we did end up working together a lot, we also, you know, kind of individually were looking at the cases. And I know sometimes with other podcasts, for the most part, you're seeing a whole season dedicated to one case or one story, and then you have the lead reporter, but maybe also this other reporter or two and their fact checker and their researcher. And so I'd be curious if people like having three cases or if we would consider doing a season with just one case and just pooling all of our resources and doing something even more expansive with one case.
So you could also either leave a comment here on the Facebook Live video or email us at caseunsolved@theday.com. Lindsay, any?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned April because that actually came up in my coverage of Erica Sirioni. They were very frustrated because they didn't know whether Norwich police had ever considered George for her. And I thought that was interesting because I believe the time frame was similar. I don't know for sure, so don't quote me on that. But no, you know, I have a couple ideas. I'm going to keep them hidden up my sleeve until I reach out to some family members.
Right, so we're still at the very early stages of having these discussions about what cases, who would be involved. So early reporting, early research maybe, right? Erica, I think you were looking at something too early.
Yeah, and that's something I'm not not quite sure yet where things are. But I mean, well, we have had though people, also just what's interested me, people in the Facebook group say, oh, this person was a family friend, or I knew this person. And so that's something to consider, too, if people are already saying, hey, can you do a case on this person?
You know, when we came up with the idea, Karen got a list from the Unsolved Task Force, Cold Case Task Force, which, as we reported, has been disbanded because of budgets. So that's where we kind of started with, and that's where we got these three cases. But, you know, obviously we're willing to go beyond that list, but you know, I think that adds to the public service that we're providing, that this cold case unit doesn't exist anymore, and so we're the ones kind of saying, hey, you know, let's think about these cases,
And reviving interest in them in the hope that somebody, you know, might remember something, somebody's conscience might be poked. Well, thank you for joining us. Case Unsolved Pod is our Twitter handle. The Facebook group again is facebook.com/groups/caseunsolved. And we'll be on there posting any updates about the coming season. Thank you for joining us.